To Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola and downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 245th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 244 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. There will be no show next Sunday, September 2nd, as we celebrate Labor Day. I hope you'll be with us the following Sunday, when my guest is poet Reggie Mara, author of the recently published Killing America, A United States of Ignorance, Fear, Bigotry, Violence, and Greed. And every Sunday night, the initiative session. Before going any further, an announcement. Writers and poets in the Upper Westchester Putnam area may wish to participate in some of the terrific writing groups in the area. The Mayapack Writers Group, now in its 21st year under the coordination of Vinnie DiQuino, meets every Thursday night at 6:30 in the Mahopac Library on Route 6 in Mahopac, New York. There are also two poetry workshops in the area. The first meeting on the second Wednesday of the month at 6:30 in the same Mahopac Library, and the second on the fourth Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak, New York. The next Mahopac Library meeting is Wednesday, September 12th, and the Shrub Oak meeting is Wednesday, September 26th. People wishing more information may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. They're open to both fledgling and published poets. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 245th in the series, my guest is poet, editor, and publisher James Paul Wagner. James, a resident of Long Island, has been a Facebook friend for a couple of years, and we belong to some of the Facebook poetry groups, but our paths never really crossed until the good friend of this show, Therese Prane Birch, became involved with some on-the-ground poetry groups in Long Island and recommended James as the guest, not only for his poetry, but also for his use of the medium of the socially responsible causes. I hope to get into all aspects of James' life on tonight's show. the listeners wishing to join James and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold a call participation and until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Okay, so let's get started. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a real honor.
Why don't you just start us off with the poem?
Oh, okay, sure. Poem that early. Let me see. Let me pull one up. Okay, this one is called 15 Songs, and it's from my last poetry book called 10-Year Reunion. In 2001, my sophomore year of high school, I got the new Gorillaz CD. They were a cool band with cool songs, and this CD had 15 of them. So thankful we'd come so far from the days of records, 8-track tapes, cassettes. My CD player came everywhere with me, going through the anguish of trying to fit the big round device into regular-sized pockets. I would listen to my songs while walking in the hallway between classrooms. I had my favorites on the CD, but listened to all of them. Got to know all of them. Just me and the band's music. Little did I know that by the time of my 10-year high school reunion, the devices we'd have would be 15 times smaller, hold over 15,000 songs on them, and it wouldn't be very often that anyone would listen to an entire album anymore.
I know that well. I had first the Walkman, then I had the Discman, then of course everything's now on MP3, and you can, and if you're an Amazon Prime user, there's every song ever recorded that you can play on your Amazon device. So it's a whole different world. Thank you very much. Where did you grow up? Then go to early school.
Well, I was born here on Long Island in Huntington, and I went to early school at St. Philip Neri for kindergarten, and then I went to a Trinity Regional School in East Northport from 1st through 7th.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably something silly like I'm, going to be the first person to go to Mars or something like that, when I was like 4 or 5. For a long time, I actually had aspirations to be a best-selling fiction writer. And, by the time I was in college, I actually did have several short stories published and was, doing okay with the fiction writing. But poetry, for one reason or another, kind of took, my main focus.
How about your high school years? Did you write for a school paper or for the literary journal?
Actually, in my high school there was a literary journal, but it was very small and it was kind of very tight knit. So not really so much in high school. By the time I got to college, though, I was heavily involved with writing for the Art Lit magazines, and actually started an Art Lit magazine when I was in grad school. So that was for genre fiction, because there was a regular Art Lit magazine that took a lot of literary mainstream fiction, but there wasn't really much for the people who wrote horror or fantasy or science fiction, so we kind of started one.
You mentioned college. Did that happen directly after high school?
Yep. Went right to college after high school, then to grad school right after college.
What did you major in college?
Well, my undergraduate was creative writing, and my graduate degree was a master's in liberal studies with double concentration. One was in literature, the other one was in social sciences.
I know that your bachelor's degree and later master's are both from Dowling College, which is no longer operational. Could you see that coming while you were there?
Yes, honestly. Not so much when I was an undergraduate. Actually, when I was an undergrad, it seemed like it was actually growing and thriving pretty well. By the time I got to graduate school, it seemed like there had been a kind of a shift in the wind, which had to do with, presidential changes repeatedly, boards of directors, some bad advertising, and a smear campaign in Newsday, and the fact that it seemed like the college was putting more resources into endeavors that seemed to be dead ends while ignoring other avenues that probably would have done better. But there was, you know, so there were some signs of it while I was there.
The Dowling property, as I'm sure you know, is the former home of the also defunct DeSalle Military Academy. Do you know what's now on the property?
Well, right now, nothing's on the property. I mean, it's owned by a Chinese educational company that was going to attempt to put another school there, but they had some issues getting the charter. So right now, it's kind of being owned by, you know, this company, but nothing is currently being done with it as far as I know. I mean, I'm sure that they have plans for it, but it's kind of in limbo at the moment.
I hope that people don't start to think that the property's snakebit if two different schools of different types went downhill on it, you know. So, how about the break for another poem?
Sure. Let me get another one. This one's also from my book, 10-Year Reunion, and it's called Just Hanging Out. Want to hang out? When? Friday night? What time? 8? What do you want to do? Food? Where? Apps? Sure. In making these plans, I remember a time when friends would converge randomly, unplagued by classes, when work was a part-time thing, meant to give you pocket money to make your own adventures, and hanging out was not preempted by a shopping list of specifics, when people weren't so rigid with their likes and dislikes, their do's and their don'ts, and when we still had space and time to figure out new things about ourselves. Let the chips fall where they may, and the company you kept was the only constant that you really needed.
I like that too, and it's reminiscent. I'm a generation behind you, but I grew up when you'd go out of the house on the Saturday morning with a rubber ball in your pocket, and you wouldn't come home until the evening, and everything was not scripted by people driving you to one practice or another, or to one band practice, or to a camp, and it was kind of a whole different world then. Now it seems that it's become, as you said about different places, it's been very, very structured for a young person growing up. Do you look at it that way?
Well, I mean, I think what I was kind of alluding to in the poem is when you're younger, you're a bit less concrete in your design. You know, you're a little bit more able to be molded differently. You take a little, a few more chances. But when you become an adult, you tend to do things on the fly a lot less, and it tends to be like, oh, I'll hang out with this person to go bowling, but only bowling and only at this specific time. It's like if the plan changed from bowling to archery, then I wouldn't want to do that. It's like it's about the specific thing rather than just about, well, we're a bunch of people doing things. And I find that to be, as an adult, I mean, there's some part of it that is, I guess, a little bit appealing in the sense that you kind of know yourself a little bit better, but there's also some limitation that comes with that. And so, just the trade-off is something I just find interesting.
Then what happened after your education, after you got the master's?
Well, I was going to, my original intention was to be a full-time college professor until, doing college part-time and then realizing that, I don't want to, the committee meetings and, all the inter-college stuff that was going on was not really for me. I kind of, when I was in grad school, I became more involved with, the outside literary communities, on a more professional level with publishing. And so I kind of wanted to make that happen more. And then I thought I would do, I might teach college part-time. And, for a while, I decided that wasn't, currently for me either. I preferred being out in the, especially after Dowling closed, it was like I didn't pursue, teaching adjunctly anywhere else because it's like, I went from a student to teaching things at Dowling and, I didn't really feel like going through it again somewhere else. But, so really the publishing company, took off while I was in graduate school in a way I wasn't really expecting. And so that kind of became, you know, what I've been doing pretty much since graduating. It's been about, you know, doing events and doing books and, you know, going on tour and doing events and giving lectures. You know, not like a lecture in the way that, you know, like you do it at a college for a semester, but like go to libraries and colleges and conventions and do, like, you know, one-off lectures or workshops or things like that.
Before getting into your poetry and poetry-related activities, let's get into your other writing for a moment. I know that you're also an essayist and a fiction writer. Please tell us about some of that work.
Well, the fiction writing was, you know, it was a lot of science fiction and fantasy, and, you know, I have a couple dozen short stories, you know, out there in the ether published under those genres, and it was, you know, it was fun. I haven't, like, truthfully, I haven't written much fiction lately because I've been so busy editing and publishing that that's kind of been taking most of my focus. But for a lot of years during my undergraduate and beyond, I was heavy into the fiction writing, and, you know, they were just little, you know, little short stories. I don't have, like, that great American novel or anything like that. Maybe one day far off in the future when I retire or things get a little bit more simpler, then maybe, you know, and I have more time to focus on that. But they were, you know, generally stories about, you know, like, you know, aliens coming to Earth wanting to be jazz musicians or, you know, silly little things like that that certain audiences just found entertaining. As for the essays, a lot of them actually had to do with autism publications and autism advocacy, because one of the earliest poetry anthologies I edited was one called Perspectives, which had to do with, you know, poetry concerning autism and other disabilities. And when that came out, a lot of autistic organizations started, you know, pulling myself and my co-editor in for interviews and to give talks and things like that. And so that led to other opportunities. And since I am, you know, I'm autistic myself, so they figured that, you know, I had this point of view to speak from. And so I wrote a bunch of essays for Naturally Autistic magazine based up in Canada, in Vancouver. And, you know, other than that, in terms of essays, I have a couple martial arts essays out there. I have some history essays out there. I am a big historical fan of Benjamin Franklin, and I'm actually currently working on a book about him from the point of view of his businesses, called Business Lessons from Ben Franklin, and kind of like what you could take from the examples he did. And even though it's hundreds of years old, people are going to be like, well, how could you apply, you know, business things from hundreds of years ago to now? But really, you know, it's all the same, because it comes down to the fact that business is people to people. And so if you're interacting with other people, those are really important things, and that's something people have kind of forgotten. So so that's basically my fiction, you know, nonfiction.
Well, he also was in the right place at the right time, because he innovated so much, not just the kite and everything, but he founded the University of Pennsylvania. He founded the post office. I mean, he was certainly one of our really multi talented people in American history.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, he didn't actually found the post office. He just made it very much improved from what it was. Because a funny thing, back before Benjamin Franklin came along, if you got a letter, the letter receiver was expected to pay the postage when they got a letter. So it's like, you have people who send to people for free, and they'd have like this big stack of letters, but there'd be a big bill associated with it. And so you'd have all these unclaimed letters in the postal service that nobody would really want to get because they didn't want to pay for them. So he's like, well, we should make them the expense be on the behalf of the letter sender rather than the letter receiver. So that's just a funny tidbit.
And now, getting out to poetry, first you describe yourself as a performance poet. What does that term mean?
Well, I mean, that really kind of varies depending on who you ask, because there's a big culture of, you know, slam poetry and spoken word poetry, which I did do a brush with spoken word when I was in graduate school, but I don't really consider myself a spoken word poet. I say performance poetry just because I tend to like to I have a little bit of a background also in musical theater, and so, you know, in performing. So when I do my poems, you know, live on stage, I like to kind of make them a little bit more animated and just, you know, a little bit more of a performance-based appeal to it rather than just kind of reading it from the page. And some of my poetry has, you know, is more written in mind with it being performed rather than necessarily just read. So that's
okay.
Really just what I mean by that.
Much of your activities in poetry have been dedicated to using poetry to support social improvement. Please tell us first about Bards Against Hunger.
Yeah, that one's actually probably one of the things I'm proudest of. About, what is it at this point? It's like 6 years ago now, actually. We were, you know, because I've been doing event planning with poetry for about 10 years now. And about 6 years ago, you know, we had success with local anthologies and gathering larger numbers of poets for things. Because, you know, truthfully, not that long ago, there used to be this kind of cynicism about the ability to, you know, gather a lot of people for poetry because poetry wasn't seen as the most popular thing. But, you know, about 10 years ago, it was almost like there was this cosmic poetry awakening, and then suddenly a lot more people started coming out for things. And so we did quite a few events where we were gathering, you know, large numbers of people, at least as far as poetry is concerned, you know, like 50, 100, 150 people for things. And around that time, we're like, well, you know, it, you know, Thanksgiving season was coming up, and, you know, that's the season when a lot of people, you know, remember that, oh, yeah, there's a lot of hungry people out there, and not just hungry people, you know, over in, you know, Africa or in other parts of the world, but there's also hungry people right here, you know, like in our own towns that seem to be overlooked quite a lot. And so we were like, well, we're having the, you know, gatherings for poetry anyway, so why don't we just have a specific poetry gathering where people read poems and then, you know, we all gather a bunch of food and then we donate it to a local, you know, food shelter in our area. And that way we could actually see the results and, you know, it shows the poets can give back a little bit. And so we did that here just on Long Island for a few years. And, you know, it was always a good event. And the good thing about, you know, local food pantries and things like that is they will actually come to your event or your location to pick the food up. So you don't even have to go and drop it off. So that's like a barrier of entry that isn't even there in a lot of cases. So working with them for a few years, and then my publishing partner moved to Northern Virginia a few years ago, and he started a poetry group down in his area, and he liked the idea so much of what we did up here that he started doing the same event down there. And so I was like, well, you know, cosmically speaking here, we've done with two events, we've gathered twice as much food for hungry people. So if we could get more than two events going in different areas, that would mean, you know, more hungry people getting food. I mean, you know, just math. So I started reaching out to other poets in other states and other areas that I had connections to via the publishing with the anthologies and such. And then the year after that, we had six different events in, you know, six different states. And, you know, six places getting food and, you know, everybody being really happy about that. And so the following year we did, it was 12 states, and that was last year. So this year it seems like it's going to be even more than that. We have actually one starting up in Manchester, UK, possibly one in Sweden. We have one, you know, then, you know, the West Coast kind of got on board too, because we had several events in California. I think there's going to be one in Washington. There was ones in Oregon, and it's just like, it started franchising in a weird way, almost becoming like a McDonald's of poetry readings. And everybody loves the idea because everybody's like, yeah, we have hungry people here too. And if we're doing poetry readings anyway, you know, all they have to do really to be a part of Bards Against Hunger is host the reading, gather food to be donated to a shelter in their area, and then we add them to our national list for doing it. And, you know, we did a, you know, an anthology and some stuff associated with that, but, you know, every reading out there kind of has its own autonomy with it, so it's a low barrier of entry. And because everybody's donating to, you know, stuff in their area directly, there's no, you know, and this is something that's becoming a little bit more important in, you know, this day and age, is there's no trust issues because everybody knows exactly where the stuff is going. Because one of the problems with, like, big nonprofits these days is they always like, okay, give us all the stuff and then we'll distribute it all over the place. But, you know, we've seen that there's some dishonesty in those situations, or there's some issues with the actual funds or the products actually getting to their location. So this model, you know, that was kind of stumbled on by accident actually, you know, seems to work in the way that nobody's really concerned because everybody sees the actual results of the labor. And so I think that's why people like it.
In many cases, too, the overall organization up on top is administrative fees and everything. And you're absolutely right about the hunger. I live in a fairly the Fluent community in Upper Westchester. And my wife and I volunteer every week in a community food pantry. And we get from the same area, we get over 100 people per regular time before Easter and Thanksgiving and Christmas. The number will go up to 200 to 300 families. And before the school year, we give our school supplies, and before Christmas, toys and everything. And I wouldn't have thought there'd be that many people in the area if that have the need of this, but there is, and it's just a tremendous feeling. The volunteers get as much out of it as the recipients. You know, so it's
definitely.
You're right. It's going to get worse. You're right.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about it too is that through doing this, you learn all sorts of things about food scarcity, you know, in America, like numbers, and you know, because the organization, at least with the one, because I mean, every Barge Against Hunger in different areas kind of does it a little bit different, which is part of the appeal. But in New York, like, we actually have the person, you know, like here on Long Island, we have the person from Long Island Cares, which is a nonprofit, comes and usually gives a little short introduction with like statistics about, you know, hunger on Long Island. And, you know, the numbers are much higher than people would think. And it's not just, you know, homeless people. It's like you got people who, you know, have, you know, a full-time job and they have houses. But once all their bills are paid, they, you know, worry about, you know, having enough for food. So that's one thing. But also just the idea, like, how much inefficiency there is when it comes to food production and food waste in America. Because, you know, a lot of people think, like, there's only so much food and there's so many people. And it's like, you know, but that's not really true. There is actually, if you actually took all the food in the world, you would have a surplus for every person in the world of food anyway. Water might be a different story, but or at least clean water. But food, you would have a surplus of. It's what we really have is a distribution problem, because the way America's cut up is you have specific foods being made for the entire country in one small section of the country, rather than what it kind of organically is more supposed to be like, where you have, you know, farms in one area providing food for this specific area, and then farms in another area providing food for this specific area, and maybe, you know, some trade, you know, along the lines. But you know, the average bit of food in America travels 1,500 miles to one plate. And when you just think about the amount of waste in distribution for that, you know, just, I mean, gas, transportation, you know, and all that stuff on top of it, it's mind-boggling. It's horribly inefficient, sadly.
You're also getting me into one of my favorite topics. I'm a technologist, in addition to being a poet, and for years we've been talking about jobs being lost overseas. Well, right now, they're not being lost overseas. They're being lost to technology. And between artificial intelligence, intelligent algorithms, robotics, we are, number one, setting society up in two stratas. And we are also taking so many jobs that people who were once not only the factory workers, but once highly paid people, for instance, a senior vice president at Kodak for chemical engineering. Well, we don't need any of them anymore. And so all of a sudden, this person that was making $250 a year may be lucky to make $25 a year, $40 a year with a mortgage and with a couple of the kids going to college. And then we have all the people that used to open envelopes at the utility company and used to key things in, and they used to go to the bank with the checks and everything. Well, with the online banking and with the direct pay and with the ATMs, you can go into any old bank that had 8 telestations, and now there's only 2 people working there. And these people, we aren't planning long range, and we have a dysfunctional government that they can't even decide what they're going to pay to build in 2 months. And it's very scary, and someone has to plan about this, or we're going to be feeding more people than have jobs, or they can afford. They may be underemployed. They may be working at McDonald's rather than as a supervisor at some bank. So that's my.
Yeah, I mean, historically, technology simultaneously kills jobs and creates jobs, and then kills more jobs. Once upon a time, you had people who were, telephone circuit board operators whose whole job was to, put the plug into the other plug and do all that. And then obviously that was there for a while. There was a lot of jobs, and then poof, it just, went overnight. But then, you've got other jobs that tend to come up with technology when it comes to maintaining the technology. But I think one of the big problems is there's been so much change in the last 20 years or so. And a lot of the, most of society and most of education, it hasn't really caught up with teaching people about the new world and how the new world is. If you're looking at it through the old model, it's really scary. But you look at it through some of the new model or some of the new possibilities, and there actually is a lot of opportunity. But nobody's really positioned right for it, and nobody is positioning people right for it, because there's some people who kind of cracked the code, and not all of them really want to share. But on top of that, I feel like, school systems need to update a little bit and maybe prepare people a little bit more for, how to create and add value in the 21st century, because it still is very much on a 20th century model, sadly.
And many people who are displaced, they're either too old or they're too uneducated to be retrained. And this is the first time, really, that technology has not created at least as many as replaced. And so we have to think about this, and we obviously get some pushback, because you talk about the schools doing things, but it's going to cost more money. And many of the recommendations for what has to happen eventually, like a guaranteed income or paying volunteers who now coach Little League for nothing and do other things just to keep people working, there's going to be heavy pushback from the upper tax bracket who understandably don't want to share too much, so it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, it's true. But considering we're talking about books and poetry here, and this is an important, interesting topic, I could take, just for relevancy here, I could talk about the topic of publishing and how it changed and is changing back. Because the 20th century model of, just living has been, go to school, get the job, and that's that. And because there were big companies that had these jobs, the idea of the job was a secure idea. But that's a very 20th century mindset. You go back before that, before the Industrial Revolution, maybe, because maybe it was like late 19th century too, but you had a lot of small companies out there. You had a lot of solopreneurs, or people who had individual trades or individual practices or individual businesses, and you had a lot of smaller businesses that maybe had like a dozen people working for them. But there were a lot more of them. There weren't really so many monopolistic type things. There weren't really so many corners of the market completely dominated, or if there was, there were other territories one could go to. And people were more trained to look at things in a way of, I need to either start my own, business or something of value, or I need to have my own farm, or I need to have my own trade, or I need to get skilled in something particular to go for that. And the 20th century, with the idea of really big companies, I feel kind of shifted the mentality. And take publishing as an example. In the 20th century, big publishing houses controlled 90%+ of the market, because they had the distribution. They had the built-in, methodology with the distribution warehouses, where they had the capital that they could put in the upfront cost for thousands and thousands of copies, which would be distributed to distributors in all sorts of areas. And then they had the ability that, because what a lot of people don't realize about publishing is they want about 1,000 to 5,000 copies at a regular distributor, and then the publisher has to guarantee to take back up to 70% of the copies if they don't sell. So you're looking at a substantial investment for every title up front. In the 20th century, only big publishing houses had the money to be able to do that. But you flash back to, say, Walt Whitman's time or Ben Franklin's time. The difference between publishers and printers weren't really as big as they were in the 20th century. Printing shops existed all over the place, and the only difference between a publisher and a printer was that the publishers were usually the booksellers. And you know, Ben Franklin was unique in the sense that since he had a network of a dozen printers throughout the colonies with his apprentices, he could make a bestseller happen like that. But not everything was like that. So you had a lot of regional areas that, you know, did things their way. And like Walt Whitman, he would, like, a traditional publisher wouldn't have accepted Walt Whitman, so he went into a printing shop and printed it himself. But the disparity between the number of copies sold wasn't as big as one would think, because you could still get a bookstore to house it, you know, and if not this one, you could go get another one. So it was really in the 20th century that the big, you know, differences between publishing houses that had real capital and, you know, little printers kind of became distinguished. And then he became, then it also became the whole self-publishing is taboo versus, you know, you need a publisher to have your name to endorse it, and et cetera, et cetera. But publishing now is kind of changing back to a little bit more like it was before, because you have small presses popping up now, and they might not, you know, they might not have the same model as something like the big bookstores. But the old model with the bookstores is not serving the big publishers anymore either, as is becoming very evident by how much, you know, Barnes & Noble is in trouble about how Borders went, about how, you know, you don't see a lot of big chains anymore. And even the big publishing houses are reporting losses, whereas you have a lot of small presses. And small press only means, you know, small in terms of how many titles you're doing, not necessarily small in revenue. Because you could have a press, you know, all that a small press means you do less than 200 titles per year. So you could have a small press that only has five titles, but each title sells 10 million copies, and it's still technically a small press, but it's not small in how it's actually operating. But you've got a lot more of those now in the information marketing field. In poetry, small presses basically have everything, because there's not really a lot of big presses that really invest a lot of money into poetry. You've got it in certain, you know, areas of self-help. You've got it in, you know, metaphysical stuff. You've got it in certain areas of fiction, even, where big presses won't touch certain topics and, you know, certain publishers will. So you're kind of getting, you know, the way that model is changing, and people are getting a little bit braver and a little bit more apt to go out and take a chance, you know, on maybe something smaller or a specific area. I feel like there's a lot of, you know, like it's a little bit of a microcosm for, I think, the changes in, you know, 20th century society versus 21st century society, just when it comes to stuff in general, is the old models are not working anymore. And so we're kind of figuring out, you know, in a sense, the older model, but for the new world. And I feel like, you know, the blend of the old-fashioned and the new technology is actually creating, in a lot of cases, some amazing opportunities that we wouldn't have before. I mean, like, this radio show right now is one example of a great opportunity that, you know, because, you know, 30 years ago, you wanted to be on a, you know, have a radio show. It's like, you know, think of what you had to do, what the barrier of entry was for that.
Yeah, I'm a little ahead of where I was going to get to, but you'll appreciate this. A friend of mine donated his library of Irish literature to the Gluckman House at NYU, and he had a rare copy of James Joyce's Ulysses, and it was almost the original publishing on demand when Joyce was in Paris. And he knew he could sell a couple of books. He'd go off to a printer, and he'd, you know, and he'd say, print me a couple, and they'd run it off on whatever paper they had. And the reason this was a rare Ulysses was it was a unique paper that wasn't used too much in the copies. So, I mean, there was publishing on demand long before it was creative space on Amazon. So I thought that was the whole interesting story about the way things used to be. That's part of the model that you're talking about, where the mm-hmm. author can decide when his book will be published, how many copies he wants for himself, whether it's going to be distributed, in this case, to Amazon. And, you know, so it's a return to more control with the author. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because the big reason, like, back in the day you needed to print a large number of copies of something was because of, you know, how much of a pain in the butt it was to set up the typeset. You know, like, during Ben Franklin's era, you better print 1,000 copies of whatever page you just set up, because it took you 3 hours to set up that page, you know, with the way that an old printing press worked. But now, you know, even back when you had things with analog, you know, you had a problem with large print runs because, you know, during World War One there was a big paper shortage. That's why, you know, Lord of the Rings was done in three parts, whereas now everywhere you see the complete Lord of the Rings is one book. Back then they didn't have enough paper, which is why they did the trilogy. But, you know, nowadays everything's on a file. You know, forget the analog where you even had to do it that way. You have it, you know, it's a file. You press a button online and you can get more. So what is the need to print 10,000 of something up front when you could print, you know, 100, and then you run out on that, you print another 100, you print another 100. I mean, you know, with like my publishing company for poetry, we've sold over 50,000 copies of our poetry. We've never printed 50,000 of something at once. You know, we tend to print 100 copies for an event, 200 copies for an event. You know, we're sending copies to, you know, Virginia for stuff they're going to have going on there. We'll send them maybe 300 copies. It all, you know, it varies based on the anticipated need of, you know, what we need. And, you know, then the benefit of that is even if we have some rollover, we don't need like a warehouse or anything to hold inventory. Because, you know, just storage of large numbers of books in and of itself becomes, you know, a logistical problem. So,
and the other thing is the people wanted to be printed by the big traditional houses because they would promote the books. Well, now the only ones they promote is if your name is Stephen King or James Patterson. The author's got to do so much of that themselves now that it's that some of the rationale for chasing this Simon and Schuster and these other people just isn't there anymore.
Yeah, well, that and also, like, you know, working with a small press or even doing it yourself, you get a bigger chunk of the sales. I mean, you know, a small press, you know, I mean, you know, for an experienced author, there's plenty of authors who start off with a traditional publishing house, then they go to a small press, and then they eventually do it themselves because, like, in the beginning, they don't really know the business side of it, but once they learn it, it becomes easier. Like, I still would recommend, you know, a small press is a good place to start off with and even a good place to keep for a lot of authors because it does prove that somebody reviewed your work other than just you. So there's that angle to it. But also they kind of partner with you and show you the ropes in the beginning. You know, you might eventually get to a point where, you know, doing it yourself makes a lot more sense because you already know everything. But, you know, a good small press, though, will have means of advertising, you know, and these days, you know, like, you know, the big publishing houses using the old model struggle to reach as many people because these days you could have, you know, somebody with a YouTube channel has access to more people than maybe a traditional publishing house, depending on how successful the channel is or what it is they're talking about or a radio show or, you know, whatever. Like, because you could have, you know, somebody who literally or an email list, you know, which is probably the best way to really actually, you know, direct market to people because, if you know, there's some people they have, you know, a lot of groups have small email lists, but if, you know, you happen to have one that's a really well-grown email list, you know, that's kind of like the way that you really direct with your fans, and then you could give them all sorts of offers, and you could get their feedback, and you could do all sorts of things with that. Like, say an author has an email list of 100,000 people. Why do you need a traditional publisher? You know, if you already have that, you have the means to get to the people yourselves. And then, presumably, you also would have the means to go around and make a partnership with this bookstore, or this bookstore, or this bookstore for a reading. So, you know, it really comes down to, and granted, not everybody necessarily wants to do the business mindset of things, which is why traditional publishers came into that. But, you know, even with a small press, they could do a lot of that work. So.
And you're also the founder and president of the Bards Initiative. What is that?
The Bards Initiative is it's a New York State nonprofit that's located on Long Island that was basically a local poetry group. And, you know, a lot of people sometimes get confused with Local Gems Press, which is my publishing company, and Bards Initiative. Bards Initiative is specifically Long Island events, specifically Long Island publications. But there are actually other chapters of it in other areas, too. Like, there's Nova Bards in Northern Virginia, where my publishing partner has. And there's actually the Buzzin' Bards in Manchester, UK. And there's a lot of, you know, the Bards Initiative was what kind of started Bards Against Hunger also. So Bards Against Hunger and all the different areas is kind of a branch off of that. But, you know, we do, you know, readings and workshops and, you know, events and slams and things like that. And so it's really just kind of like a local poetry group, but it's a really vibrant, popular poetry group. And it hosts, like, you know, the biggest poetry events on Long Island. And, you know, I'm really proud, like, with the numbers of people who come at the poetry events there because I haven't, you know, I do a lot of traveling for poetry and lecturing, and I haven't really seen too many poetry communities that have the same hyper-local base is Long Island, but I do think that part of that is the geography of Long Island, because, well, first, there's like 7-8 million people on Long Island, but we've also got like this bottleneck thanks to New York City being right there. So I go to an event, like, say, in Northern Virginia, and they have people there from Maryland or D.C., you know, West Virginia, stuff like that, like people cross borders. I go to an event in Connecticut, they got people from Massachusetts, Rhode Island. But on Long Island, you know, got a lot of just Long Island people. But, you know, because everybody's got to go through the city almost as a bottleneck to get in or get out, or you take the ferry to Connecticut. But, you know, so I think geography has a little bit to do with that. But yeah, I'm, you know, it's been around for 8 years now, and I'm really, you know, really happy with how the group has grown over the years.
I was attracted to the name Bard because my name on many of my poems is John Mack the Bard, and my wife picked that out when I complained that there was this English poet that I liked who had this great name, Sullivan the Poet, and I said, gee, I wish I had thought of that. Not Sullivan, but John Mack the Poet. And she said, why don't you be John Mack the Bard? So I have been. So I like the name. How about... Mm-hmm. Another poem? Yeah.
Okay. Let me bring one up. Pulling one up here because I'm on my computer. Okay. This one's another one from 10-year reunion. Maybe at some point I should read one not from 10-year reunion, but that's what I have up in front of me here. So this one's called The Small Commons. By the time of my junior year, after my various awkward phases, when I'd managed to amass a rather large assortment of friends from various categories of high school, there were certain rituals that we had formed. Hangouts, meetups, activities, etc. But every day in the early morning before first period, when the buses had dropped people off and I walked in, we all met up in a space known as the Small Commons, the huge circular hall of locker after locker by the English wing at the east entrance of the school facing Elwood Road. Dozens of us, all unhappy with the early, early hour that we were forced to be there, using each other's company to cope with the inconvenience, discussing the previous night's episodes of the various shows we watched, sharing video game strategies, complaining about the various classes, some of which we shared, some didn't, joking, laughing, before the bell divided us, sending us off to gym or science or math or history or English, or if we were lucky, a free period. Though our days might have been divided, we always had that morning. And as I've gone through life in various jobs to running my own business, I sometimes long for a Small Commons early morning ritual with jokes and friends to kick off my days with a smile.
I like that, too. It's so reminiscent of... I go to the monthly meeting in the neighborhood I grew up in, a monthly lunch, and I still am in touch with people that I was very... very close friends with 70 years ago. So it's the memories, they're great. On the commercial side, as you already mentioned, you're also the publisher for Local Gems Poetry Press. Tell us something about the press.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that I tell everybody, and nobody really ever believes me when I tell them, but the whole poetry press kind of got started completely by accident. And I didn't grow up, you know, I wasn't like 6 years old thinking, you know, when I grow up, I want to be a poetry publisher, you know, what happened was I was in graduate school at the time. And like I mentioned earlier, I was kind of going with the idea I was going to be a college professor, but I was involved in a lot of extracurricular activities and clubs at the school. And one of them was the spoken word club. And, you know, we had a really nice group of young, energetic poets who were all really good at performing and, you know, alliteration. You know, they had a little bit of work to do on the literary side or, you know, grammar, for example, but they were, you know, they had a lot of high energy and it was really exciting and it was good, you know, good for poetry in my opinion. And then, you know, since high school, I've been going to other events on, you know, Long Island before I started my group. And I was working, you know, one of the part-time jobs I had while I was in graduate school was working for a website called examiner.com, which was a hyper-local, you know, topic place where you would basically write blog posts, and every time, you know, somebody would, click on your story, you would get 1 cent per click based on advertising. But, you know, and you got to pick, like, your topics and stuff. I mean, it's not there anymore, but it was, you know, back then it was, you know, interesting and innovative. But so I was writing for the Long Island Poetry Examiner, and so I was going around to a lot of the groups and talking to the group leaders and interviewing them, and, you know, so they kind of got to know me. So I kind of wanted to get all of these poets together in the same spot, both from both of my college and from these other places. But, you know, to put it bluntly, I didn't really have the street cred in poetry that I do now. So people would kind of be like, oh, yeah, that would be great, but, like, nobody would ever actually make an effort to really get together. And so I kind of thought, like, you know, I need to get a way to get these people into the same room. So I had this little notion that, well, you know, I had some experience self-publishing some of my own little crappy books when I was in high school. What if I gathered a bunch of their poems and put them all into the same book, and then I had a launch event at the same place? Then they would have to come out to get the book, to read from the book, and they would get to see each other. So through the poetry club at Bowling, you know, we set up a launch in their ballroom, and I put together this little book. The first book was 39 poets, which I remember back then thinking, wow, that's a huge number. It come a long way since then. But, you know, and the book had a nice cover. Now, the formatting was a little bit of a nightmare, but that's another story, you know, the first attempt. But so got these poems, put them together. We had the launch event at Dowling, and, you know, a bunch of people came out. You know, almost all the poets were there, because had like a built-in 12 just from the Dowling Club, and then a lot more came in, including some of the local poet laureates, you know, from Suffolk County, Long Island. And everybody had a great time, you know, but since it was sponsored by the club, we had, like, free food and stuff. So it was great. Everybody got to meet each other. It was a grand old time. And then people were like, okay, so what's the next book you're doing? And I'm like, the next book? You know, I wasn't really planning on a next book. You know, I was just thinking of this as a one-time thing. But then, you know, my friend Mark Rosen, who was writing with for Examiner.com for Perspectives, for Autism, had the idea about let's do poetry for autism that I mentioned earlier, and that's how we got Perspectives, the poetry concerning autism. And that book kind of just took off at full speed and, you know, brought all these opportunities, like was not expecting out of nowhere. And then it's like, okay, so now what's the third book you're going to do? And it's like, well, now we've really set a precedent, so we kind of have to, you know, keep on doing these poetry anthologies that people love. And then for a while we were just doing poetry anthologies on different topics, and then we kind of had, you know, an annual one every year that's just general poetry. But then once that was going on for a while, we started getting, you know, knocks. Hey, I have a book of my own poems. You know, would you guys publish that? And I was like, well, you know, there's other presses on Long Island that handle individual authors. We're really kind of just anthology people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. One by one, though, all of those small presses, for one reason or another, either stopped publishing or changed the way they published or started publishing way fewer things, and they're pretty much all gone now, with the exception of, like, one that I can think of. And so now the demand in the area was really high to publish, you know, individual poetry books, as you have all these events and all these workshops, and there was no real local publisher anymore. So I was like, okay, you know, the one person who was, you know, submitted regularly to a bunch of anthologies, like, okay, we'll take a chance on doing your book. Once we did this person's book, a dozen more came in, and then, you know, we started doing some of those, and then more came in, and it's like, you know, it kind of just took off in that direction, and really, it never stopped since. It kind of just, you know, it had a way of governing itself. Like, I wish I could say that it was like some grand plan of mine, but the truth is that, you know, the needs of the local environment and the local market dictated it. It kind of pulled me in the directions it needed to go. Every bright idea I ever had in my own life blew up in my face. Everything good that happened was something that I wasn't expecting, to be totally honest.
Yeah, I've been very lucky like that too my whole life. Joe, send me the URL of the Poetry Press this inventory so I can publish it in the article. I'm interested in some of your titles. Now, locals in the title, are the poets limited to Long Island, or could I, a Westchester native, submit work for consideration?
Yeah, that's something people ask a lot when I say, why local gems if you're publishing people from all over the world? Because now at this point, you know, we have published titles from all over America and some other countries. And we also had anthologies where people were submitting to from, you know, all over the world, like five different continents. And they say, so why does it still say local? It's like, well, because the big mission that we really like doing is we like encouraging local poetry groups. They don't have to necessarily be our local poetry group. Because one of the things in recent years, like through Bards Against Hunger and through other things that we like doing, is sort of kickstarting or putting a little fire into local poetry groups in different areas. Like when Nick Hale, my publishing partner, moved to Northern Virginia, he started a group down there. And so there's this local group down by him that even if like us up here in, you know, New York are reading the stuff from them, it's still from their local group. So local gems was the idea of just, you know, finding, you know, kind of diamonds in the rough in your local area. But yeah, it's become international in terms of, you know, where poets submit from. So that's, you know, people from, you know, we have projects, like there's some projects that are specific by region, because we do have annual anthologies like in Long Island and in Virginia and in other places that are just for specific areas. And through Bards Against Hunger, you have like Indiana edition Bards Against Hunger, Kansas edition Bards Against Hunger books. But a lot of the, you know, there's a lot of anthologies that are take submissions from anywhere. And when it comes to reviewing manuscripts, you know, we've had contest submissions from everywhere. We have people send us stuff from everywhere. So, you know, no limit on geography.
Okay. I believe that Therese Birch has a poem in one of your publications. Am I correct? Hello?
I think she actually has a couple I think she's in Bard's Annual, and I think she's also in the Suffolk County Poetry Review, if I remember correctly. So, yeah, she's a couple times. Funny story, actually, her daughter was actually one of my professors at Dowling when I was an undergrad.
Okay. You know, of the small worlds. Do you have another poem handy?
Yeah. Let me just ring it up here. Actually, here's one not from 10-year reunion. This is called The Library Company, and it should hopefully appear in my upcoming poetry collection, which will hopefully be out in a few months, called Everyday Alchemy. Once upon a time, in a city called Philadelphia, a group of tradesmen got together to form a club for mutual improvement, known as the Junto. They would write papers to read aloud, discuss current events from the points of view of their different occupations. Fisherman, carpenter, candle maker, all offering a fresh perspective. The printer of their group, a young man named Benjamin Franklin, had an idea that since books were in short supply, all members of the Junto should bring theirs together to the clubhouse so that anyone in the group could read and benefit from their little makeshift library. All of them spent countless hours flipping through all those pages. Seeing the success of this endeavor, Ben wanted to take it a step further. Each member could contribute a small financial amount to order books from England and then charge the general public of Philadelphia a small membership fee to the library company for them to come and read the books and lend them out, forming the first lending library in the country. Think of how much could be accomplished by the average person if they had access to this information, Benjamin used to profess. I think about this now, in the information age, where the average 12-year-old has the sum of world knowledge at his fingertips in their pockets to call up at any given moment, information that the Junto would have killed to know, and I wonder if Ben Franklin would think that we're making good use of it.
I like that, too. You have also been on the advisory board for the Nassau County Poet Laureates Society and the Walton Birth Prize Association. Would you tell us what they are?
Well, the Nassau County Poet Laureate Society is a group that votes on and picks the next Poet Laureate of Nassau County here on Long Island. And the funny thing is I live in Suffolk County, but a bunch of years back when I guess they had come, you know, several members of that committee came to some events of mine and they just invited me to, you know, help advise them on, you know, their doings. And so I said, sure. Right now I believe it's in a consultant aspect because I don't really go to the meetings much anymore, but I also helped them start their publication, the Nassau County Poet Laureate Society Review, you know, which is, you know, a bunch of poems and poets from Nassau County and beyond on Long Island. And the Walt Whitman Birthplace, I work with them in a lot of things because we tend to do, we actually do our big events of the year there at the Walt Whitman Birthplace State Historic Site and Museum. And, you know, I've helped advise them when it comes to, you know, poetry and local stuff. I actually am I'm going to be also teaching workshops there to their, you know, the students who come in for the tours from the local schools coming in the fall. But the Walt Whitman Birthplace, it's one of those little treasures that not even everybody on Long Island even knows it's there. And a lot of the people, like even poets for a long time, tend to not know it was there. It's right across the street from the Walt Whitman Mall, which everybody knows the mall, but not everybody knows that, yeah, the actual, you know, building where Walt Whitman was born is right here on Long Island. It's like a 15-minute drive from me, and, you know, it's a very nice place because the building is still intact. There's a courtyard around it, and then there's a little museum area in the birthplace with a bunch of Walt Whitman artifacts. And, you know, it's a real treasure, and we love doing poetry events there because of the heritage. And, you know, it's like we're right next to a book, you know, a physical book, copy of a book that Walt Whitman had worked on, or a printing press that he had actually used, you know, when he was publishing his newspaper. So it's really incredible.
It's interesting you mentioned the Poet Laureate Association. I'm the Poet Laureate of the town of Yorktown, and at some of the readings, I've had the Poet Laureate of Orange County and of Beacon, New York, and we've been reaching out toward people from other areas like that. So it would be interesting if we could do something like that here, or if we could even hook up with your group.
No, I was going to say, like on Long Island, we actually had a publication not that long ago that I published called Laurels, which is actually a collection of all, up until that point, all the Suffolk County and Nassau County Poets Laureate. An anthology, but just of the Poets Laureate's work. And that was a, you know, we had a really great event where we had the most Poet Laureates from Long Island in one place at one time that we actually did at the birthplace. And that book has actually been used in, you know, local schools and stuff like that, actually in curriculum as an example of poetry. So I'm really proud of that.
You should be. Finally, you're the National Beat Poet Laureate of Long Island for the 2017-2019 term. What is a Beat Poet Laureate?
Yeah, that's something I'm still trying to figure out, because I didn't really think that I was a beat poet, but apparently I am, according to the society anyway. The National Beat Poetry Foundation, like, you know, because the other thing about laureates is there's a lot of different ways one becomes a laureate, because there's like county laureates, there's state laureates, there's town laureates, and then there's you know, like, so it's kind of different for every area and the process is different. But the National Beat Poet Laureate Foundation is a national and international organization that, you know, runs beat poetry all over the world. And they, you know, they select people from different areas who fit their criteria to kind of represent them in beat laureateship, and, you know, people who host events and do a lot of contributions to poetry and to beat poetry. And again, I'm not quite sure, you know, that my poetry is exactly beat, but they seemed to like it enough to, you know, to give me that title. But that was really, you know, it was more of an award from this group. And, you know, with that, I really kind of, you know, do the, you know, what I've pretty much always done, which is organize events here. But I've also, you know, attended that, you know, that festival and performed there. And actually this year is their 10-year anniversary, and I've actually was the publisher for their 10-year anniversary anthology, which is like 125 poets from all over the world, and actually going to be premiered actually this upcoming Labor Day weekend up in Connecticut over the 3-day festival they're having there. And that's going to be, the book is going to be launched, and there's going to be readings from it, and a lot of, you know, beat laureates from different areas are going to be there. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, congratulations. That's great. Oh, we have a caller from the 914 area code, 528. Let me see who this person is. And the person just left. They just hung up when I was going to put them on, so I don't know exactly what that was all. What's next for you?
Well, immediately next, probably going to get some food, but You mean like in terms of projects and stuff? Well, one thing that I'm, you know, been working on here on Long Island with, you know, fellow poet named Linda Trott Dickman, who is actually the Bard's Laureate of organization, is we've had this program going for the last couple of years called the Apprentice Poets. And that's actually, it was actually started with an after-school club of poets at Norwood Avenue School, which is an elementary school, and this was primarily third to fifth graders. And we had a series of poetry workshops with them, and then we put forth a little chapbook of their poetry and had like a recital launch with all their parents and their family coming out, and it, you know, became pretty big. And we did that for a couple of years, and then we got invited to present a proposal for that program to the Nassau County BOCES Library Group, and presented that in front of like 60-something school librarians, and they loved it so much that they want us to present this proposal in front of the big convention they're having in November, which is all the school libraries on Long Island, Nassau, you know, Nassau, Western Suffolk, Eastern Suffolk, about possibly expanding this program to other schools. And that's something that if enough schools actually take that on and actually follow this model, that would be, you know, kind of like really helping to encourage, you know, a next generation of poets around here. Because one of the problems a lot of, you know, poetry groups have is they always want to work with the youth, but there's not really a lot of ins, because sometimes schools get a little defensive. And they're like, you know, like even the poet laureates, when they approach schools and they try to get something with them, the schools would be like, ah, we have our own poetry instruction. We don't, you know, necessarily need that. But, you know, so if this actually, if that actually happens, I'd be really happy with that, because there's, you know, in poetry, you tend to have two major age groups in poets that I found in what I do. I mean, obviously there's people from all ages, but the biggest two age groups, it seems, are college kids or kids just out of college, who, you know, either aren't really fully set in what they're doing yet, or are, you know, still in school and are really enthusiastic about creativity. And then people on the other end who have just retired or getting close to retirement or past retirement and have a lot of time and really are dedicating it to their art and their craft again. You know, and you only tend to get really sprinkles of people in between those ages. So, you know, there's, when it comes to youth poetry, it's, you know, there's not a lot collected out there in the, you know, the mainstream grassroots, you know, poetry groups. I mean, you got a lot of scholastic poetry, like poetry going on in the schools, but it's not really organized in a way where people get to experience it or share it. So, you know, beyond their little groups. So if this happens and, you know, we can come up with like an annual festival for, you know, like showcasing all these young poets, you know, these young apprentice poets, that would make me really happy. But probably the other thing that's actually coming up in 2019 is Whitman's 200th birthday. And we're actually having a convention here on Long Island from May 31st through June 2nd to celebrate Walt Whitman's 200th birthday. It's going to be that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and we're going to be having a bunch of poetry readings, you know, workshops, seminars, you know, events, things like that to kind of celebrate, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
And in many cases, it's the schools that have ruined people's appreciation of poetry when you get locked into only reading the classics and to being told everything has to rhyme and everything like this. It's only if you can get to young people. Now, I am going to be doing something with seniors. I'm going to be developing the workshop through a library for seniors who can hear poetry and then they can write and then there can be the criticism. We've covered a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about James Paul Wegner?
You know, I'm really not sure, because I don't know that, you know, like me myself, I don't really consider myself like to be all that interesting or, you know, that important. I really just am very happy that I'm a part of this very big thriving poetic culture and that, you know, I get to kind of give some contributions to it. You know, one interesting thing, though, that I've actually noticed, and, you know, maybe other people will have noticed this, too, but, you know, maybe I'm a slow learner and I'm just noticing it, because in the last few years, because Bards Against Hunger has been growing, I've been traveling around to a lot of different poetry communities and different, you know, different areas, and I've been seeing poetry communities all over the place, and one thing I'm kind of discovering is that it seems like a lot of these groups all formed around the same time, around 8 to 10 years ago. And, you know, which is why I kind of like joke about this, you know, great poetry awakening that seems to have happened about a decade ago, because it seemed like all these people around the same time sort of got it in their heads that they wanted to, you know, start up a poetry group, or they wanted to, you know, start doing more readings or workshops or become active with poetry in their area. Now, obviously, logically, one can say that's when social media started becoming really active and it made it more possible for people to connect. But I kind of prefer the metaphysical explanation of there was a great poetry awakening, kind of like, you know, the Italian Renaissance or periods in history where certain things just kind of came up, because it sounds cooler.
Well, there are so many poetry groups just on Facebook. There must be 35, 50 of them. It's just so many different types. That's what exposed me to one sentence poetry and to three word per line poetry and to and to dark poetry, you know, and it's, and the poetry superhighway that I was the poet of the week once on. You know, it just, there's so much of it there that has to interest all of the people that go on. Well, some of the people, or a few of the people, of the half billion people that go on to Facebook, you know. So that I would assume is has some responsibility for the interest also.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think it's because it communicating between people became easier, and you know. And that's part of, like, what I meant earlier to come full circle about the opportunities that the 21st century and new technology actually affords if people just kind of, you know, tweak the way they look at things a little bit and you know, start to see the opportunities that are there. Because, you know, I feel like because, you know, like you said, like school kind of almost trains people to not like poetry, and that's one example. You know, part of that is twofold. Part of it is because, you know, the curriculum is picked tightly. And part of it is also because some of the teachers themselves are intimidated by teaching poetry because their experience with poetry wasn't any better. And so when it comes to the poetry that they're supposed to teach, they don't really, you know, have necessarily the same understanding of it that, you know, they might, because it wasn't taught to them properly either. And so it's a small section in creative writing that they kind of have to muscle through, and they just use the stuff that's in the book, and that's that. So that's part of it. But I also, you know, there was a professor who I had once who taught a poetry workshop, and people would take his poetry class and they would swear to never write a poem again, because the person had a very, very strict, rigid idea of what poetry was and had a very, you know, very systematic way of doing it and didn't really allow for different types. And to me, that's kind of like the opposite of what his job was supposed to be. But, so you do in some cases encounter that. But, you know, the good thing is now there are so many alternatives to that, and there are so many resources out there. And one of the things we like to do with Local Gems also is we don't just publish pure poetry, but we also like to publish poetry instructional materials. Every year we have a book called The Poet's Almanac, which is, you know, like we publish it before the month of April, and it's a bunch of poetry prompts. It's kind of a multi-purpose little book. It's a pocket-sized book. It's got space in there to actually write. There's poetry prompts for 30 days, but it's really up to 60 days. There's a couple of short poems in there. Then there's some poetry facts and some things about poetry. And there's usually like an essay or an article or something about something to do with poetry. That's one example. We've also, one of the things that I've been, you know, getting more well-known for in the last few years is going around to a lot of Japanese culture conventions, because myself and my partner had a best-selling book on Amazon called Japanese Poetry Forms, which, you know, has become kind of, there was no book like it when we first wrote it, and it's, you know, because of that, it's kind of filled a void there, because there's a lot of, you know, there's interest in Japanese poetry forms. Everybody knows the haiku, but there was no definitive book that was a guide to the different forms and like the 1,000 years of poetry that came before the haiku. So
right.
We did that, and, you know. So we like the instructional side of things too. There's always, you know, one of the things we're actually looking to do in the near future is do online poetry workshops or poetry seminars. And even from the business side of things, because I have a book called Selling Your Poetry Book, and I give seminars to our authors about how to market their poetry book. Because sometimes poets have a habit of only trying to sell their poetry book to other poets. And, you know, that's kind of limiting, because if that's all you're doing, then it's just a group of people lending money to each other. You know, it's not really, you know, there's other people out there who will like the poetry, especially if, you know, there's a topic associated with it. Because we've had people who write books on breast cancer, and then, you know, they sell their poetry books you know, at all these breast cancer conventions or at all these, you know, medical meetups, because one of them's actually, an MD. We've had poetry about autism. You know, the topic drives it. You know, we've had poetry about all sorts of things. So, and that's the great thing about poetry, is it's a blank check. It becomes whatever one makes of it.
I have one poem that's first to quote Joyce Carol Oates, who said that as many people write poetry as read poetry, and then I quote Billy Collins saying that she's wrong. More people write poetry than read poetry. So I think that's probably indicative of the way it used to be anyhow. So.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about that is it's not entirely true. It just has to do with how it's framed, because people read poetry every day. They just don't realize it's poetry. You know, you have all these corporate seminars where they're training their people and they're giving them these little mantras about positivity. Those are all poems. Every, you know, Hallmark cards are all poems. Dr. Seuss,
sure,
poetry. You know, it's all poetry. It's just when you word it as poetry, it suddenly becomes intimidating and it becomes very big and scary and it becomes like a flashback to that horrible section they had to deal with in school, like you said. But,
right,
you know, in recent years, though, people are starting to kind of realize that, you know, maybe that's not all what it is. Because there's another project I'm really proud of, is there was a book that was just done at Hope House Ministries here on Long Island. And I went to the launch, which was held at this place. And this is a place, it's a homeless place. It's a halfway house. It's, you know, a place for recovering, you know, people who just got out of the prison system, or people who are recovering addicts and all this stuff. And there's a workshop that goes on at this place every Friday night. It might be every Sunday night now. But, you know, you would get these people would get up, you know, to read from this book that we did. And I'm talking, it's like this, you know, huge tattooed guy, shaved head, you know, like Sons of Anarchy looking, gets up there and reading, you know, like My Heart, you know, like just like reading a poem, you know, from that. And then it's like, you wouldn't expect that a bunch of criminals and former drug addicts would get together on a Friday night to write poetry. But yet they are. And they realize how powerful it is and how, you know, emotionally validating it is, and how, you know, they feel a sense of accomplishment for doing it. And it's funny, because you would never think it in a million years, but it really does have that power.
And I think that people are starting to realize that it isn't just a metaphor to call Bob Dylan and Paul Simon and Billy Joel poets, particularly after Bob Dylan wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. That's so many of these people, like I always considered Kris Kristofferson a poet, and it's the same kind of thing that you're getting poetry without realizing that it's poetry.
Oh yeah, well, you know, for a long time there was really no major differentiation between music and poetry, because poetry was the way you conveyed a story, and the music and the acting was just, you know, like the spice on top. You know, somewhere along the line, the instrumentals of music became more important than the words. You know, and you got pop music, and, you know, sometimes the words don't necessarily matter in pop music, and sometimes they do. But, you know, a lot of the really good music out there, the lyrics is poetry.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you very much, James. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I think, you know, it was a lot of good topics discussed and a lot of interesting ways it went.
Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com. And join me in 2 weeks on September 9th for my interview with another poet, Reggie Mara. And go to my website, www.johnmack13.com. for the URLs of previous shows and the schedule of upcoming shows. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. And because it was a Long Island show, let's go off with Billy Joe. Amazon, play Piano Man.
Playing piano from your library. Thank you.
shuffle in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin.
Thanks again, Jim. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.